What common word did you notice in those songs this morning? Anybody? In the title. You can just read them and it'll be the same word in every one of them. Come. Throughout all of history, since the fall, there's been that theme, a desire, a longing for Jesus. In His first advent, they looked forward to the coming of the serpent who would, the seed of the woman who would crush the serpent's head. The desire of every nation was that seed of Abraham, that through him all nations would be blessed. And since He's ascended to the right hand of the Father, ruling over His people, actively establishing the church age, we cry out, Maranatha, come Lord Jesus. Should be a longing for seeing Him face to face. This morning we're going to be continuing our Advent series. We're going to survey the book of Ruth. Four chapters of the book of Ruth I'm going to do today. It took me about 2 years to do four chapters of the book of Philippians. So we're going to be condensing and choosing what material we're going to hit and just hitting the highlights. But please be turning to chapter 1 this morning. While you're turning there, Job 14:1 tells us that man who is born of a woman is a few days and full of trouble. This truth has remained unchanged since the fall of Adam in the Garden of Eden. Life is tough. It can at times be absolutely soul-crushing. And that's the case for Naomi and Ruth. The book of Ruth could very easily be named Naomi because it's really more centered around her than it is even around Ruth. We see in Ruth chapter 1 verses 1 through 2, it came to pass in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi, and the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. We see that there were times here of bitter providence. That's true of us. There will be times of bitter providence. In these times here, it was days when the judges governed over Israel. We know from the very end of Judges that that's not necessarily a good time. Judges 21:25, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. King hadn't arrived on the scene yet. Was no king. And the outcome was that everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Verse 1 tells us that not only are the judges governing, and there's a bit of chaos implied in that, that things are not as they should be, there's not a king ruling over the people, but there's also a famine in the land. And famine at that time, they didn't have a grocery store. Famine meant mass death and disease, and it was bad. Elimelech was an outlier. It seems, even his name would imply that his family was part of the faithful remnant. Elimelech means El, God, and Melech means king. So God is king in the Hebrew. He was a man who was still faithful to Elohim, to the God of Israel, and looked to Him. But even with that man there, he had two children, and Mahlon means to grow weak or fall sick. And Chilion means to fail or to stop or to come to an end. In other words, annihilation. So this God is king, this man that's recognizing the kingship of God, what had he seen in his life? He had seen growing weak and falling sick. He had seen an end of the blessings of God. He even names his children after the annihilation of all of his hope around him. That was what had marked their entire life. Many times I think we've had it tough when we don't even understand tough. They had it tough. That had been what Naomi had known, but she at least had Elimelech, a rock man she could look to, a leader. I don't know why they went on this sojourn. No commentaries provided for us concerning whether it was actually a good or bad thing in the sight of the Lord. I don't know for sure. He was a man who apparently was a good man and a good leader in his home, but was leaving God's promised land and Bethlehem, the house of bread, and seeking something better somewhere else, a good thing or a bad thing. Don't know. But I do know that whether it was faithless of him to leave or not, to pursue bread somewhere else, it was a man acting as best he knew how to provide for his family. He didn't know what to do. He was desperate. So he leaves Bethlehem and goes to the land of Moab. And then it gets worse. It's bad for Naomi, but she's got Elimelech. And it gets worse. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And she was left with her two sons. So it's bad, but at least she has two sons. They took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And it gets what? Worse. Sometimes it seems like things just get worse and worse and worse. And when you think it can't get worse, it just goes and does it, doesn't it? And that was her story. And the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. And we only feel a part of the weight of these verses today. We don't feel the full weight of that because we grieve with Naomi. We can identify with the loss of a spouse. We can imagine what that would be like. She didn't have to imagine. She experienced it. We can feel the anguish of the loss of two sons to some extent. But this was a patriarchal society, so we don't understand fully because Naomi couldn't go back to school to complete her degrees and just get a good job and support herself. This had economic implications as well. She didn't have anybody to provide for her. She had no father's house to go back under. Typically, at that time, if you had younger sons, your daughters would marry the oldest living son, and then you'd have somebody to take care of you in your old age through their offspring. But she had no other children than these two. Children at that time were the retirement plan. People say, "Oh, I can't afford to have children. I can't afford to have more children." Children were economic benefit at that time and still could be today if we raised our children right. Put that out there. It's not in the text, but it's in my mind. It is in the history. It is in the culture. Children were trained and brought up to contribute to the household, to be a blessing to the household. They were considered men, recognized as men at 12 years old. And expected to work and contribute. And now it's outlawed for kids to work when they're 12 years old. Something's wrong. That's neither here nor there. She had none anyway. She was there with only two, Ruth and Naomi, and nobody to take care of the three of them. So in Ruth 1:6-13, we pick up the story. She arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. So she departed from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, and this must have been hard for her because she had nobody else except for them, but she knows what's best for them. They need someone to provide for them. And then she says, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you find rest each in the house of her husband." Go and marry somebody that can take care of you, because I can't. I'm willing to be all alone because I want what's best for you. I love that about Naomi. She really was a woman who thought of others more than she did herself. Which is also an Old Testament truth as much as it is a New Testament commandment, isn't it? And she kissed them, and they all lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, but we will surely return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters. Go, for I'm too old to have you a husband. If I said I have hope, even if I could have a child, if I should marry a husband even tonight and bear sons, would you wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." Her interpretation of that is God is against me. God has set his foot against me. We can feel that way sometimes when things go from bad to worse and from worse to worse still. That's how Naomi felt. She did not, however, cleave to the whatever comfort and solace she might have. She still thought of the best of her daughters-in-law. Point that out again. Wanting them to do what's best for them. But I'm going to say this. It can feel like the hand of the Lord has gone against us. It can feel that way sometimes. But for God's people, that is never really the case. And I want to tell you that. That is never the case. When's that the case? Never. Romans 8:28 is not sometimes true. It is always true. All things do indeed work together for the good of those who love God and are the called according to His purpose. It's always true. So losing Elimelech, losing her two sons, being in this famine-stricken land, having no hope in any temporal sense that she could see, felt like the Lord had gone against her, that the Lord was against her. But I'm telling you, when you feel that way, it wasn't true for Naomi, as we're going to see, and it is not true for you. There are times of chastisement. I'm not sure whether this was just providence or if this was chastisement for him leaving. If that was something that just brought hardship and judgment on the family. But even judgment from God, even judgment from God is for our good. Hebrews 12:7-14. "It is for discipline that you endure. For God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom the father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons." So if you're a son, will you have discipline from the hand of God? The Bible assures you that you will. Furthermore, it says that we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they, earthly fathers, disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but imperfectly. I do not discipline my children perfectly, but you know the Lord knows exactly what you need and has your best in mind. And when He's disciplined, He does it perfectly. That's what this verse says. For He disciplines us for our good so that we might share in His holiness. He knows how to make you holy and to provide for all of your needs perfectly. And even when He disciplines, He's doing it for that reason. Every time. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. You'll be better after the hard times that God inflicts you with than you were before them. He uses them to purify His people without fail. Therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. So walk straight so you don't have to be disciplined, but even if you don't, He'll discipline you and He'll make you walk straight. It's good news. Avoid the discipline if you can by being upright. Pursue peace with all men and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. Spurgeon said this. He said, "No honey was sweeter than that which dropped from the end of Jonathan's rod, but that is nothing compared with the sweetness of the consolations which comes through Jehovah's rod. Our brightest joys are the birth of our bitterest griefs." We pick up the story in Ruth 1:14-22, "And they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpha kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her." Then she said, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." Orpha went back. "You, Ruth, you do that. That's best for you. I want you to do it too." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people. And most importantly, your God shall be my God." We've got a Gentile woman who says, "The God of Israel will be my God, and I will rest in the shadow of His wings. He will take care of me." It makes no logical sense. You're right, Naomi. You can't have another child that I could marry, but I'm going to do right by you, follow you, trust in your God, be faithful to you. That's what Ruth said. "When you die, I will die, and there I will be buried." Where you die, not when. "Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me and worse if anything but death parts you and me." When she saw that she was determined to go with her, when Naomi saw that she was determined, she said no more to her. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" You know, she's in part right. The Almighty did inflict her. But it only seemed for a moment that it was bitter, as you'll see. And a moment sometimes can feel like a really long moment. So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. So when those times of affliction, when life is hard, in times of bitter providence, what do? We go back to God's promises. When hard times come, Naomi certainly shows us what to do here in this book. Return from the land of Moab. If you're out and things get hard, don't go farther out. Come back. Come back to the Lord. You're out of His land, come back to His land. That's what we do. Many times we get out of the will of God, we're afflicted, things get hard, we harden our heart against God and we want to go farther away. Do not do that. Run back. Go back. Return to the house of bread. Return to Bethlehem. She goes back different, though. She goes back, but she goes back different. She's a broken, jaded shell of herself. Sometimes that's true. If you think, "I'm a broken, jaded shell of myself, I can't go back." No. You're a broken, jaded shell of yourself, so go back. Okay? You are where you are, but you can't be fixed elsewhere. Go back. People asked, "Is this Naomi?" Naomi means pleasantness. "Is this Naomi?" I can almost see the worry lines on her face. The ache and the pain wearing it on her. You can just see the hardened features on her face. Is this Naomi? She looks kind of like her old self, but she's changed. She's hardened. She's embittered. But she's still returning to the house of bread. Where else could she go? She had nowhere else to go. That's where she went. Would God be faithful to her? Would He sustain her? In this chapter of tragedy, we see only two real signs of hope at all. God has turned Naomi's barren daughter-in-law's heart toward her in pity. And Ruth means pity, distress, or grief. That's ironic to me. Ruth, who means pity, had pity on Naomi, and God turned her heart to her mother-in-law. At least she had that. Why do I say she's barren? This is going to come up later. Well, at least the author of Ruth wants you to think that she's barren. Ruth 1:4 says, "They took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of one was Orpha, the name of the other was Ruth, and they lived there about 10 years, and they had no children." That just didn't happen. That's not normal. Right there. They weren't on the pill. Wasn't one. So 10 years of marriage and no children. So she has a daughter-in-law that has stayed with her, but even that daughter-in-law was married to a son for 10 years and had no offspring. Still no economic hope in that. And the second thing is that it's harvest time in Bethlehem, and God has smiled on Bethlehem, and she's going back to the house of bread. That's all she's got. It's a little hope, but man, in light of all that she's been through, it's just a little hope, isn't it? In chapter 2, we see this unlikely ray of hope, though, right at the very beginning. And it says, "Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz." A wealthy man named Boaz. Matthew Henry says, "Of her rich kinman Boaz, a mighty man of wealth." The Chaldee reads it, "mighty in the law." If he was both, it was a most rare and excellent conjunction to be a mighty man in wealth and mighty in the Scriptures too. We know later that he was mighty in the Scriptures because he understood his scriptural obligation inside and out. Exactly how things should be done. Those that are so mighty are mighty indeed, if you're mighty in wealth and mighty in the Scriptures. He was grandson of Nashon, who was the prince of the tribe of Judah in the wilderness, and son of Salmon, probably a younger son by who? Rahab, who we looked at last week, the harlot of Jericho. He carries might in his name, Boaz, which means in him is strength. So here she is in the weakest place she's ever been, worse and worse and worse, two tiny things that you can't even really pin any hope as, but then you have Boaz. In him is strength, a rich man who's mighty in wealth and in the Scriptures. Oh, wouldn't it be amazing? If you're reading this for the first time, you're thinking, wouldn't it just be amazing if Boaz helped this woman? Oh, you just hope it's going to happen. Rich, noble, and mighty in God's law. Why is this Boaz being mentioned, you wonder? What might God do? Picking up in Ruth 2, 2 through 3, "And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, 'Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor.' And she said to her, 'Go, my daughter.' And she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech." The Bible is full of miracles. Floating axe heads. That's one I've always thought was really neat. Parting of seas, angelic appearances, healings, even the raising of the dead happens in the Bible. But there are huge sections of Scriptures where no such miraculous occurrences take place. Ruth, we have no angelic appearances. We have nothing but just normal, ordinary, everyday, mundane occurrences. But I'm going to tell you something. God is at work in every "it just so happened." It says here that Ruth just happened to be in Boaz's field. Ruth just happened from human intuition. But in God's plan, Ruth did not just happen to be there. God was bringing about something and brought Ruth to Boaz's field. Whatever just so happens that you're going through, I want you to know that God's right in the middle of it. That He's there. The book of Ruth is testimony to that. There's nothing to stick out here to say. There's no warm fuzzies. There's no even sense of God's presence mentioned here. Not only no angelic appearances, but not even that they recognized that God was doing anything except for "it just so happened." Many times in the middle of your "it just so happened," God is working mightily to deliver you from all the mess, from all the bitter providences. God's hand is right in the middle of many "it just so happens." Wait expectantly in those times. Return to the house of bread and wait expectantly in those times. Those things that seem like just so happened are divinely appointed and are part of God's great plan to accomplish good for you if you are His every time. So we pick up in Ruth 2, 4 through 12. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." And they said to him, "May the Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his servants who were in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" The servant in charge of the reapers replied, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, 'Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves.' Thus she came and has remained from morning until now. She has been sitting in the house for a little while." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap, and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. When you are thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your sight, that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" And Boaz replied to her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you have left your father and mother and the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." Everything we do, we think that goes unnoticed in the path of faithfulness, and nothing goes unnoticed. God uses your walking in the path of faithfulness to turn people's hearts to you. Am I talking about works-based salvation? No, I'm talking about God turning Boaz's heart to Ruth because of her faithful walk. And God uses that in your life. That's exactly what we see happening here. So now we're in a little better situation. They're able to glean in one. She's able to glean just in one field, but you know there's something better on the horizon. Something better than just having enough bread for Naomi and her to survive. Even in the story, we have Boaz saying, "Leave a little bit more. Drop some on purpose so that they've got plenty." That's good news. They aren't going to starve. That's good news. But God's doing more than that in the story than just providing for their temporal needs, which is important. He's doing that and more. You know, the third thing I wanted to point out, if not, my points aren't great, but there are times of bitter providence. Going back to God's promises in those times, second point. And then thirdly, that God blesses and we see it. But He has done and continues to do more than we have seen or expected. God's always done more than you realize. You think you see the blessing of God, or the hand of God, the hand of providence, how God has directed your life, and you're grateful to the extent that you see it, but God's done more than you realized. He has done more than you realize and is going to accomplish more than you could ever fathom. You can forget that and drive yourself into despair, but don't forget that. We should ask God, "Show me more of the blessings that I'm experiencing that I can see, but there'll always be more still. And God, do more than I see that might happen." I tell you, I am guilty of this. I came to church today. It's filled up a little. I come, and there was hardly anybody here at 10:05. And I'm thinking, what am I doing? I'm trying to be faithful. And it seems like instead of growing, we're shrinking. Instead of people being more excited to get here, they're less excited to get here. I'm saying we should be here early to prepare our hearts for worship, and increasingly they're later and later. I'm not harping on you, I'm just telling you. That's how I felt this morning. And is this doing anything? And then I remembered, hey, I'm preaching today that God is doing more. He will accomplish more than we expect. There are stories that will be told in eternity that are connected to what we are doing here, what Tommy's doing here, what David's doing here, Doug, the Nordmost. What you're doing right here, right now, is part of His providence, and He's going to do more through it than you could ever dream. You'll get to revel in that one day. I believe that. And we'll see, oh, that's what God was doing in that little time when I felt like I was forsaken and forgotten. Things were falling apart. They weren't falling apart. Ever. God's right in the middle of it. He's doing more than you expect. We see that first on Ruth's first day of gleaning, don't we? Boaz gives Ruth all she can eat for lunch. She works till sundown. She returns to Naomi and gives her the leftovers from lunch and all the grain. She tells what has happened with Boaz. And in verse 20, out of the bitterness, a ray of good, old, pleasant Naomi's theology shines through. It's still in there. What she knows and believes to be true about God, still in there. She's became bitter, but she's still pleasant Naomi at heart. She still remembers what she says, blessed be he, Boaz, by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. God's kindness. It's not talking about Boaz's kindness right here. Blessed be he, Boaz. Let Boaz be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living and the dead. I haven't been for... There's a change of tone going on right here where she's now believing and trusting in God again. His kind... Earlier, God's forsaken me. He's forgotten about me. Maybe Orpha and Ruth have been faithful and good to me and good to the dead. But the Lord has dealt bitterly with me. But now, well, no, wait, hold on, time out. God might be doing something here. Man, isn't it amazing how that one little good thing can happen? It might not even happen yet, but one good thing sparkling on the horizon that might happen and we can be fixed. It's crazy how fickle we are. Oh, a good thing might happen and then your spirits are lifted. I think that happened to Naomi right here. Wait a minute. Boaz is rich. He's mighty in the scriptures and in wealth. What if God's doing something and you light up? Let me tell you something. Before that sparkle happens, know that God might be doing something and trust Him. Why does it take so much to make us believe what He's promised? Boaz had just begun to show kindness to the dead, but God was, it seemed, had forsaken it. And she said, no, God hasn't forsaken the living or the dead. The Lord's kindness has not forsaken the living, Naomi and Ruth, or the dead, Elimelech and Chilion. Well, they're dead. Yeah, but they're alive. Right? They're dead, but they're alive. And He's still being kind to them and their progeny. After they're dead. It was the Lord who stopped the famine. It was the Lord who bound Ruth to Naomi in love. It was the Lord who preserved Boaz for Ruth. Ruth did not just happen to come into Boaz's field. The light of God's love has finally broken through bright enough for Naomi to see it. Now she sees it. It was going on the whole time, but now it's coming over the horizon. And oh, there it is. And it was there the whole time. The Lord is kind. He is good to all who take refuge under His wings. But it gets better than the promise of immediate needs being fulfilled. Ruth and Naomi get more than a meal ticket. Picking up in Ruth 3, 1 through 11, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it might be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman? With whose maid you were," I can see her getting excited. I hear her voice building and to crescendo while she's talking. "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it might be well with you? Boaz is our kinsman." That's the spirit this is being set in. "Boaz is our kinsman. With whose maid you were. Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Go wash yourself, therefore." I'm not recommending this as a dating tactic, but this is what Naomi says. "Make yourself as pretty and smell as good as you can, Ruth. Anoint yourself and put on your best clothes and go to the threshing floor, but do not make yourselves known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you shall do." She said to her, "All that you say I will do." She submits to her authority, even doing something that seems a little bit outlandish here, but she says, "Okay, if that's what you're telling me to do, Naomi, that's what I'm going to do." She does. She went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came in secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. It happened in the middle of the night that while the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, the young woman was laying at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she said, "I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." She's a little forward here. She seems to be about proposing marriage, doesn't she? "Boaz, you commended me for seeking covering under the Lord's wing. I'm saying he's going to use you to be my protector." She's saying, "I need you." Then he said, "May you be blessed of the Lord. My daughter, you have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence." Two things stand out in Naomi's strategy in verse 1 through 5. I just said Naomi's strategy. Her what? Her strategy. One is that she has a strategy. That's the first thing that stands out about it. And the other is what the strategy is. The sheer fact that Naomi has a strategy teaches us something. People who feel like victims don't make plans. As long as Naomi was oppressed, as long as she could only say, "The Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me," she conceived no strategy for the future. That's what Piper suggests here. I'll change that just a little. I disagree. Her strategy was more simple and less hopeful, but she did return to the promised land. So she had a strategy, but it wasn't a very hopeful strategy. And it wasn't a very developed strategy. "I'm going to go back to the house of bread." That was all she had. Very limited, very primitive strategy. "I'm going to go back to God. Go back to the promised land." She returned to the land of her God and to her people who were God's people. But I pick up where I fully agree with Dr. Piper here. He said, "One of the terrible effects of depression is the inability to move purposefully and hopefully into the future." Strategies of righteousness are the overflow of hope. When Naomi awakens in 2:20 to the kindness of God, her hope comes alive and the overflow is strategic righteousness. She's concerned about finding Ruth a place of care and security, and she makes a plan. When we have hope, we will plan for the future. We will say, "How will I accomplish something?" And we'll move forward. When we become jaded, dejected, we sit idly and we go through the motions. We've got to be careful at Manorville Fellowship not to say, "Oh, wow, things aren't growing like I want. It's not going like I like. Things aren't progressing as I thought they might," and become in despair and lose our hope, lose our anticipation of God moving in great ways. Thus, we just sit and we quit planning. We quit working. No. Not that. We've got to have that hope and then move strategically, expecting God to use our spirit-wrought efforts to build His kingdom. That's what we've got to do. We must act to expectantly put ourselves in the path of blessing. I like to say it that way. To expectantly put yourself in the path of blessing. You think of Zacchaeus. Jesus is coming that way. I've got to go put myself in a place where I can see Him. And he climbs a sycamore tree. We've got to find where our sycamore trees are and go climb them. It's a good strategy. Put yourself in the path where Jesus is. Find it and go there. Blind Bartimaeus, he knew where Jesus was. He goes, he's blind, he wants his eyes open, and he places himself in the path where Jesus is going, expecting that then God will move and do something miraculous. We've got to think and then place ourselves in the path of blessing. We're going to forego surveying the rest of the book. There are a few more elements of the narrative that cast doubt over whether or not Boaz will marry Naomi, but he does. So I'm going to skip forward to that. The story doesn't just simply end, though, with a happily ever after love story between Boaz and Ruth. Because our fourth point is this. This story, and every story, and your story, if you're a believer, is about Jesus and not about you. So we've seen that life has bitter providences. When that happens, we run to the promises of God. And we recognize that God is doing more than we recognize, more than we have seen, and is doing more than we ever will be able to wrap our minds around. So therefore, we act and strategically place ourselves in the path of blessing. Why? Because this is all about Jesus, and His glory is due to Him. And if you're yours, He will equip you and gift you and use you to get glory for Himself and to bring His people to Him. Because He is worthy. The Lamb who is slain is worthy to receive the reward for His sufferings, and we will reach every one of them. All of them will be one. Not one will be lost. You realize that? Everyone. Let's remember back, though. How is this story about Jesus? This story begins in the time when the judges governed, right? The judges are governing. But what's the promise all the way back from Genesis? Judges aren't going to govern. We're going to have a king, right? You're supposed to be a king. And the story begins with the death of Elimelech and Chilion. Terrible death. It starts at death, hardship, pain, anguish. Story began with Ruth being presumably barren, 10 years married and no children. That's how the story starts. But now let's remember who Boaz is. He is the grandson of Nahshon, who was the prince of the tribe of what? Judah. Where's the king? Where does he have to come from? He has to come from Judah. Boaz isn't just somebody. God's doing something about Jesus right in the middle of the story. The son of Salmon, probably a younger son of Rahab, the harlot of Jericho. And then we remember also out of who Boaz is, that the seed of the woman would one day crush the serpent's head, that all of our hopes, that the enemy being destroyed is wrapped up in the coming of this king through this line of Judah. This is bigger than just Naomi and Ruth having some bread, isn't it? That a descendant of Abraham would one day bring blessing to every nation, that a king would one day be born from the tribe of Judah, that the kingship would one day leave Judah for a time but then return for it forever. And in order to have an eternal kingship, you've got to have everlasting life, don't you? You can't die and have an eternal kingdom. Somebody's going to beat death, aren't they? And could it just be that in the middle of just it just so happened with no angelic appearances whatsoever that God is working out something that's going to crush death and bring life and immortality to make the bring the gospel on the scene? Is that maybe what God might be doing? But then we've got this problem, though. Remember, Ruth is presumably barren. How does that have a role in the narrative? A presumably barren Ruth, how does a presumably barren Ruth have a role in this narrative, this meta-narrative of all Scripture, from the seed of the woman that's going to crush the serpent's head to this coming king? How does a barren woman have a role in that? Pick up with me in Ruth 4, 9 through 22. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses today that I have brought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today." All the people who were in the court and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez and Tamar, who bore to Judah through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman." Who will give it? So twice in this little section. May the Lord make the woman coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who the Lord will give you by this young woman. So Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife, and he went into her and what? The Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. So these people know that Boaz marries this woman, see that God's doing something, but then they pray that God will do this for Boaz and that he'll open her womb. And then it says the Lord enabled her to conceive and she gave birth to a son. You know when God likes to work the best? When it seems the least likely. In times of utter and total despair, when everything seems like it's a lost cause, when God works then, everybody goes, wow, God did something. God likes to do it that way. He doesn't like to work through powerful and smart and intelligent and articulate or eloquent. I mean, I'm a preacher. You look at that. He doesn't like to do that. He likes to work through weak vessels and unlikely instruments. He loves to do it when nobody thinks it can happen. And the fuel of this, in this, is prayer. You see that? The people are praying, and then God hears, inclines, and answers. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today. Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today, and may His name become famous in Israel." Who's this redeemer? Well, you might think it's talking about Boaz at first reading, the kinsman redeemer. It's not. "May He also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you is better to you than seven sons who has given birth to him." It's the one she gave birth to. It's this line. It's going to end in one that's going to be a greater hope than this offspring himself is. It is a foreshadowing of the greatest hope we could ever have in the birth of this one who would come, Jesus. "Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. The neighbor women gave him a name, saying, 'A son has been born to Naomi,' and they named him Obed. And he is the father of Jesse, who is the father of David." They can't. Oh, in the time of the judges, God's working out that it would no longer be the time of the judges, but it would be the time of the kings. And in the time of the kings, He's working out that it'll no longer be the time of the kings, but it'll be time of the king, singular, who would rule over His people Israel for all time and all eternity. And God's using this little barren Moabite woman to bring that about to Naomi in the time of bitterness and despair and ugly hopelessness. But God was never out of the picture. Not for a moment. And these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron. And to Hezron was born Ram. And to Ram, Amminadab. And to Amminadab was born Nashon. And Nashon, Salmon. To Salmon was born Boaz. To Boaz, Obed. To Obed was born Jesse. And to Jesse, David. All of a sudden we realize that all along something unimaginably great had been happening. God was not only plotting for temporal blessings of a few Jews in Bethlehem, He was preparing for the coming of the greatest king that Israel would have, and that's not King David. Isaiah 11, "Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse." From the stem of Jesse, we get this kingship. We get this David, the Davidic kingship, and it's passed down from son to son to son, to descendant to descendant to descendant, until finally that tree's chopped down, isn't it? There's no Herod's illegitimately king. And then a shoot springs up from that same line. Out of the tribe of Judah we get Jesus, son of Joseph, son of God, son of Mary, the seed of the woman who crushed the serpent's head. The deep satisfaction of the Christian life is this, guys, and I want you to hold this. If you get nothing else, hold this. Our life is not meaningless, and it's not trifling, and it's not mundane. Serving a widowed mother-in-law, gleaning in a field, falling in love, and having a baby, there's nothing miraculous, really miraculous in the true sense of the word that's happening there. For the Christian, these things are all connected, though, to eternity. Every toilet you scrub or loan you close or piece of drywall that you screw up to the ceiling, however you do that, whatever that is. Whatever you're doing, God's in the middle of it. God is in the middle of it, working out a plan, and your faithfulness in every one of those little things matters. It was Ruth's faithfulness in those things that turned Boaz's heart to her to make him willing to take her as a wife. And through that offspring, we have Jesus saving His people from their sins. And He'll use your faithfulness to save people from their sins. It'll all be based on the work of Jesus, just like Ruth. It was all Jesus, all going to Jesus. But all of us image bearers are working as part of God's plan to bring His people to Himself. And it all matters. Every continuous, stressful moment matters infinitely. Before Christ came, God was working out these trivial details to bring the Savior into the world. As we await His glorious return, know that He is working out those trivial, sometimes painful providences to apply His already completed work to His people. You are part of the great narrative, whether you realize it in the moment or not. So, I leave you with this. Be faithful and expectantly obedient. Expectantly and obediently put yourself in the path of blessing. Expectantly and obediently be faithful and wait and see what God will do. And I'm going to tell you this, it will be glorious.